Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. A common refrain among people troubleshooting a lot of things, really, Linux, certainly Linux servers, is, did you check the logs? That's what people are always asking, and rightly so. That is a great way to check for errors. And that's kind of what ulogd, which is the first package in the list, is meant for. Ulogd is the user space logging daemon. It is the thing that creates log files and updates log files for netfilter or IP tables. There is a startup script in /etc/rc.d. It's called rc.ulogd. It's pretty simple, straightforward. It starts ulogd, which is an executable located at user sbin ulogd. There is a configuration file in /etc. I think it's, /etc/ulogd.conf. So pretty straightforward. You can look at it to discover things like where the file gets saved to. By default, it goes to var. I should say, by default on Slackware, it goes to var log ulogd.log. So if you want to look at it, if you're running IP tables or netfilter, then you should be able to look at it there. And then it's got a list of plugins that aren't enabled by default. You can get information about those through ulogd itself, ulogd --info, and then path to the plugin. You get some information about it if you need it. A lot of the plugins are fairly sort of self-descriptive. I mean, something called like ulogd_output_mysql.so. Guess what that does? Yeah, it makes your output suitable for MySQL. And there are lots of different formats you can choose from here. This is really cool. I don't know how many logging daemons actually offer this, but I mean, there are a lot of options here. There's XML output, SQLite 3 output, PCAP output, Postgres, MySQL, JSON. There's just so many options for how you want to look at your logs for this. And that just seems really useful because, yes, Linux and Unix tools are very good at parsing text. But at some point, sometimes it's just like, no, just give it to me in the format that makes sense for me. And that's just such a great little feature, I think, to have. So, yeah, if you're curious about ulogd, look through the configuration file. It does describe a lot of its defaults, and then you can also just go to netfilter.org/projects/ulogd, and there's a lot more information about it. That's it. Okay, next one is UUCP. This is an old classic, and by classic, I mean probably not a command one would normally really use. I will say that the setup is very, very long. You can try to read through the info manual, the info pages included with UUCP, but it will take you hours, and by the end of it, I believe you will not really truly understand how to set this up. That has been my experience anyway. If you really want to try it though, which I honestly do not recommend, it is a very painful process. If you want to try it, go to tldp.org. That's the Linux Documentation Project. That's tldp.org. /how-to/uucp-how-to-4.html. And there's let's say it's 1,000-line article on how to set up UUCP, how to configure it. There are 2, 4, 6, 8, at least 8 configuration files that you have to create pretty much from scratch. And if you try to divine what those are from the info pages or the man page, you will get it wrong. I guarantee you. It just doesn't make any sense what is documented, or rather how it is documented. TLDP does a very, very good job of explaining exactly what you need to do. The problem, though, is that UUCP, I mean, in order to run it, if you were legitimately going to run it, you would either be just running it inside your own network and it would not be outwardly facing, or you would be using it through S-Tunnel, which we previously covered in an episode, or you would be running it over, I don't know, like a VPN or something to tunnel that traffic, because it is just, it's UUCP. It is a very, very old protocol or command rather, and it uses an old protocol. It literally believes that it's dialing out of your modem. So that's what the dial out group is on Slackware and slash Etsy slash group. Is it groups or group? I always forget. One of those two. That's what dial out is. So, or that's one of the things that you can access through dial out. And so you can use your TTY, your Getty interface and figure out what your modem is and send traffic out that way. You're connecting to someone else's UUCP communication and you log in with just a password. And it's just, it doesn't, I would not be running this on a public network. That's just, or, you know, a public facing network that I can't imagine doing. You would definitely want to tunnel this. In principle, though, I think UUCP still has kind of a lot going for it in a weird way. And that is that it expects to be automated. It is part of the setup process that you schedule, I mean, redundantly, you schedule in a couple of different places where, when your computer should call, and it traditionally for UUCP, it expects to be calling over a modem. So, and you can use your TTY to do that. It's explained in the tldp.org article that I'm referencing, and I guess I'll put in the show notes. But the concept is that it expects to be scheduled. It expects to sort of process itself at certain times, and then it doesn't actually do the thing. It's not like an SCP, for instance. It logs or it files a request for work, a work order, if you will, with that remote system, puts it into the, you know, the UUCP spool or whatever, and then the remote system does the work request whenever it gets around to it, whenever it has the capacity to process that spool file or whatever. So the idea of kind of like this, you know, you might not be available, or rather I might not be available to receive the file that I've just requested from you for the next 8 hours, but hey, keep it in that spool file and keep, you know, keep trying every now and again until I'm back or whatever. So I do feel like there is a little bit of that, there's some value there of like, we may not expect to have immediate access to everything all the time, but we are still able to file work orders and we'll know that they'll happen eventually. That obviously wouldn't be useful for everything. Like sometimes that would not be convenient, but I could see how it could be convenient and even kind of sort of necessary in a way under certain circumstances, given very old systems or very remote systems that don't have internet access or something. But I mean, first of all, I'm just coming up with scenarios, right? I'm pretending that I can imagine some scenarios. I mean, like maybe there's a scenario where an orbiting entity around a planet is only within range. Like, I mean, I used to talk to satellites a little bit for a job, for a TV broadcasting job. So we literally did. We had windows of time where the satellite would be over our location on the planet, and that's when we could talk to that satellite. So, you know, maybe something like that would make sense. But even in these sort of future space age kinds of scenarios, or very not space age and regressive and like not very advanced or remote areas, even in those situations, I just don't see that UUCP itself would be necessarily the correct tool for the job. I mean, maybe it is. Probably you could come up with something a little bit even maybe arguably better just with like some tool like SSH or Ansible plus SSH or something like that. Some other system that has a lot more sort of safeguards against just random requests made to remote systems. Next package is VLAN. This is a package that helps you configure a VLAN on your network, or rather, I should say, on a computer in a safe way. And if you've ever tried to set up a VLAN in real life from scratch, like without any assistive tools, you know exactly what I mean. You can break a lot of things with a bad bad VLAN configuration, especially if it's a trunked VLAN and so on. So you definitely don't want to try, I would say, messing around too much with this if you don't know what you're doing. Although I will say the VLAN package has a great tool called vconfig that makes it really easy and it's really exciting. It's a really, really nice tool. I wish I'd had it back when I was configuring VLANs. So a VLAN, it's a virtual LAN. In real life, like in physical space, a LAN is a local area network, and ostensibly that's kind of enough for, you know, I mean, that's it, like, right? That it's all the computers that are hooked together, that's your LAN. But what happens in real life in very, very large networks, especially, you start to get performance issues due to traffic issues. People are sending messages all over the place, or, you know, their computers are sending, chattering on the network. And sometimes it just, that's a lot of traffic to be sending over your entire network. There's just no need for every computer, in another building or maybe on a different floor. It probably wouldn't be in another building, because for that you would probably use a VLAN, a trunked VLAN connection, possibly. Or maybe VPN. I don't know how you set up your network. But anyway, like, there's no reason necessarily for the people in accounting to be getting all of the network traffic generated by your developer department or whatever. It just literally just so their computer is going to say, no, I'm not the computer you're looking for, that kind of thing. So a VLAN helps you create an imagined sort of barrier or a border line between the different segments of an actual LAN, and saying, well, even though there's no technical need for it, I want that section over there to be on its own pretend LAN. I mean, yes, it's part of the bigger LAN, but I don't want it to have to get bothered by all that traffic. And the way that that works functionally in the kernel, because the kernel is enabled with VLAN functions, is that packets get tagged with some indicator of which VLAN they're destined for. So if a computer thinks it's going to send a message out from your network interface card to the entire LAN, it's not really you doing the tagging, but your computer with a VLAN set up and so on would tag that message or that traffic just to be going to VLAN 5. And then the traffic only goes to that segment of your network. It doesn't bother everyone else where, you know, for whatever reason, you know, those people don't need to be bothered by this traffic. It just goes. Now, that means that the packet header is a little bit bigger than usual, because now it has this new tag on it that normal IP traffic doesn't have. So that's why you need VLAN functionality. Like I say, the kernel has that built in at this point, so it's not really a problem. So the package itself says it's VLAN 802.1Q configuration program. That's what this contains, and it says the package contains the vconfig program. And indeed it does. It's a great little application, super simple to use, and like I say, actually quite safe. Like, you can do configuration of a VLAN just straight with the IP command. You can do like IP link add link, whatever network card you want to add this VLAN to, and then you name it something and type is VLAN and the ID is, I don't know, 5 or something like that. That's great. But if you don't do a bunch of other configurations after that, you're liable to lose connection to that computer. If you're SSH'd in, you're liable to lose your network connectivity. Who knows? So a little bit dangerous to just do that without knowing what you're doing. But vconfig is amazing. It just, it does all that other stuff for you. So if I do a sudo on this, I'm just doing this on my virtual host here. So if I do a sudo user sbin ip adder show, I see that I've got a loopback device as usual, and I've got an eth0 device. Okay, so eth0 is my only network interface card. So I will use that as the location for my little VLAN that I'm going to set up. So I'm going to do a sudo space slash sbin slash vconfig. That's the command in this VLAN package. Add add. So we're adding an interface, and I'll show you how to remove one in a moment. Eth zero space 5. So the Eth zero, again, name of the network interface card as reported to you by the IP adder show command or ifconfig, whatever you please. 5 is the arbitrary choice of a tag that I've chosen. It doesn't have to be 5. It could be 500. It could be 100. It could be 2. Whatever you want it to be. I chose 5 because in the documentation of the VLAN package, which is a little bit scattered, but it's a good read. Add Eth zero 5 was the example that they provided. So that's what I'm going with. You hit return and not a whole lot appears to happen, but if you do sudo user sbin ip adder show, I've got a new interface here. I've got my loopback, I got eth0, but then at the very bottom here, I've got eth0.5 at eth0. So what's happened here is that a pretend interface has been sort of tacked onto my real pretend interface. It's a virtual machine. So, but yeah, if we imagine that the virtual machine exists, then we would say that the NIC is real, and we would say that the VLAN thing that I've just created is tacked onto that real device. So it's an imaginary device embedded within a real device. To get rid of one of these things that you just created that you don't want, maybe, you can do sudo sbin vconfig. I'm doing the full path because on my virtual machine, I don't have the path of sudo set. So it doesn't know where vconfig is if I don't put it in the real path. So sudo space slash sbin slash vconfig rem, as in remove, R-E-M, eth0, eth0 5? Eth 0.5? I don't remember how the notation is, actually. There it is. Yep, that was it. So eth 0.5. Now, what you do with this VLAN, I mean, the one that I just deleted, but once you do, if you set up a VLAN, what you do with it, or I should say a VLAN interface, what you do with it is, I mean, that's based on the network. So you can utilize that network interface. I mean, you can try, like, ping, this will fail, but ping dash capital I for interface, eth 0.5, some location on a network. But right now, you probably don't have, like, certainly there's no route, so you'd have to add a routing table, or if you've got your switch somewhere, or if this computer is your switch, then you would be adding routing information so that things tagged in a certain way would get directed and, you know, to the correct VLAN. And you also might have to set up the trunk, which is kind of the VLAN-less default path of traffic. Like, if it doesn't have a VLAN tag, then what happens to that traffic? Well, it goes to the trunk. What is the trunk? You might have to define that. And all of that is, I mean, that's really going to depend on what you're setting up, what kind of network you're setting up, what kind of, functionality you need out of your virtual LANs. And that's outside the scope of vconfig, because vconfig does exactly what I just demonstrated. It sets the interface up and it tears it back down if you need it gone. So we've talked about a couple of different FTP servers lately, and here's yet another one. This is the VS FTP daemon, it stands for Very Secure FTP Daemon, and it says explicitly, it's not a guarantee, obviously, but it was written from the ground up with security in mind, and obviously it's kind of on the admin, really, which is you, dear listener, to figure out what kind of safeguards on the system you want to have in place. So, yes, VS FTPD understands that the modern world has moved on from the FTP servers of, 10, 20 years ago. So it's something for the modern age, I guess, but I mean, I'm just reiterating what they say, really. I mean, like, what are your concerns? Like, what would your concern be about an FTP server today? It's up to you. Are you going to run it in a container, an intruded environment? Like, what kind of safeguards are you putting into place to make sure that there's separation between your system and the rest of the world? Well, whatever that is, whatever you decide on how you're going to run your FTP site, there are some pretty cool features in VSFTP, including SSL integration so that you can have encryption from start to finish. So that's cool. You can have virtual users. You can have virtual IP configurations. You have per user configuration options as well. So you don't have to just sort of say, okay, all users who can authenticate can do all of these things. You can have like literally just, you can single out this person, a known entity to me, this person has these permissions. This other one, they registered yesterday, don't really know who they are. They seem to be behaving well. Let's give them different permissions or whatever the scenario is. I mean, realistically, you're not going to be looking at that many users. Well, actually, realistically, in 2024 and beyond, probably FTP, you're not going to get that much traffic. So yeah, or not that much authenticated traffic. So there's FTP. Just like Pro FTP, it is integrated into the Slackware system by way of /etc/inetd.conf. Is that what the file is called? Yes, it is. /etc/inetd.conf. So if you do, if you open that up in your text editor and do a search for FTP, in my system, I get taken down to Pro FTP because that was the last time I used this file. So I'm going to comment that out, and then I'm going to uncomment the line set up for VSFTP. And this just, it's FTP, stream, TCP, no wait, root, user sbin, TCPD, and you'll recall the TCPD daemon from a couple of episodes ago, how it specifically cited that this was a wrapper used within inetd. There it is. And then finally, the name of the application that wants to get run is VSFTPD. Okay, so having changed that, I can now do a sudo /etc/rc.d, rc.inetd restart, if it's not already running, or rather restart if it's already running, start if it's not running at all. And it says that it started the internet super server daemon, user sbin inetd. Okay, that's great. So now I'll go to my physical host here and use ncftp, FTP, although you could use LFTP if you wanted. I'm just going to use NC. NCFTP 192.168.122.82. So I'm logging in as an anonymous user. It says it's successful. If I do an LS, there's my hello.txt file, which is exactly what I would expect in my test FTP server. So I'll just exit, and I will not save that as a bookmark. So yeah, that's as easy as it is to start a VSFTPD server. It's super, super simple. The configuration file for the server itself, I mean, starting it is in inetd.conf, but the configuration file for the server itself is located in /etc/vsftpd.conf. Simple enough. Open that, and it's well commented. It's got all the sort of defaults that you would, I guess, hope for it to have, maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. I shouldn't say that. I don't know what you want in your configuration files. But you have options that are pretty easy. You just uncomment them. There's anonymous underscore enable equals yes. So I enabled that so that I could log in as an anonymous user. But you can also do a local enable yes. So you could just roll in your local users so that they can log in. That's kind of handy. Write underscore enable yes. That enables any form of FTP write command. Maybe you wouldn't want to do that necessarily. It depends on your setup. And so on. And there's anonymous upload enable. That's commented out by default. So if you really want to let that happen, you can uncomment that. Not so sure about that one, though. I probably wouldn't have that on. And you can just kind of scroll through there. You'll get a good feel for the capabilities, and you can try out different options there. It's really that easy. And like I say, the startup script, I think the one like potentially confusing thing is that the startup script for it is inetd, which there's so much in inetd that you may or may not remember that it's there. So that's the thing to remember, is that VSFTPD gets started by inetd on Slackware. I mean, you could make your own start script, you know, and do it separately, but that's where it is by default. Super easy setup, as you could tell. I did it in real time. It was that easy, that fast. Really, really nice. Okay, so next is wget and wget2, but I'm feeling the urge for a cup of coffee, and I imagine you are too. So let's go get some coffee. We'll come back. We'll finish up the show. Thank you. Okay, we're back. We have coffee. I'm just saying that, trusting that you have coffee. Let's see. There's listener email here from Matthias, and he says, you've discussed mail in episode 575. The letter H, given at the prompt of mail, lists the inbox. And of course, Matthias is correct. I must have either misremembered, or maybe I was just saying H because I just kind of assume, you know, you get into the habit. Oh, H gives help. Well, not for mail. So if you do the mail x dash dash set empty start equals true dash dash file path to your inbox, then you get to that interactive mode again. So you got the little question mark prompt. And if you want help from that point, it's another question. You type in question mark. So now your prompt looks like question mark space question mark. You hit return and you do indeed get a list of useful commands that you could type in. And it's quite a long list. You can't pipe it to less, I guess, because you're in a interactive prompt. So that's a little bit troublesome. But I mean, hopefully you have scroll up. You're on a modern computer. You're fine. It's Q to quit. And of course, H. So if you press H, you show headers. H is the option to show mail headers. I mean, you'd need a message to show those headers for, but that's what H actually does. Another message here from Lost in Bronx, and this is an amazing one. Remember a couple of minutes ago, or tens of minutes ago, I was talking about UUCP and how I would never use it? Well, Lost in Bronx says that there's a tool called NNCP, I think this is, for the record, the first time someone has submitted feedback before the topic has come up. NNCP, I mean, that's probably not true, but it sure seems like there was some prescience involved here. So NNCP, don't get it confused with NNCP, the neural network compression algorithm. This is NNCP located at NNCP Go, I think, NNCPGo.org. That's where you want to go to, NNCPGo.org. This is a really cool tool. It's basically, I don't actually know if it does, but I mean, it is widely regarded, as far as I can tell, as the modern UUCP. It is, as I said, node to node copy. So not Unix to Unix copy, but node to node copy. And that does, I mean, it really takes all of the benefits of UUCP and capitalizes on them and adds other things like shared keys and that, you know, in encryption and so on. To the mix. So you can, for instance, create rules for NNCP. So there, again, a little bit of setup here, but I mean, then again, it's not 8 configuration files, first of all, and you're not transmitting things over a modem, and you're not setting up individual users because you're afraid that the wrong users will get to the wrong systems and so on. But anyway, NNCP uses modern authentication and encryption, and it uses essentially a spool file or a queuing system, so that you can tell NNCP what the address that you want to contact is when it's available and what kind of transfer you want to initiate when that is available. So, I mean, one of the use cases I've seen online is I'm traveling, I have a bunch of photos. And while those vacation photos are probably very important, they're not important enough to saturate my tethered connection to my mobile phone to back up those photos, like gigabytes of travel photos. What I really want to back up are just my, my vital, I don't know, work files, let's say. Why am I on holiday and working at the same time? I don't know. Well, I didn't say I was on holiday. I was traveling. So I've got work files, but I've also got travel photos. How do I sync one and not the other? Well, in NCP, you could set up rules for that. You could say, this stuff is fine to copy over. This stuff is not, except when, you know, within, you know, when this local IP address is actually available again or whatever. So you can set up in NCP to make calls at certain times to accomplish a task until that queue file or that spool has emptied. And then it knows that it doesn't have anything left to copy. And the crazy thing is that node-to-node copy doesn't care what it is contacting, really. You have, you know, it just sees It can see an attached file system like a USB drive or a remote server. I mean, it doesn't care what it's copying to, as long as that spool file that you've told needs to, these are tasks that need to be accomplished. It doesn't care where those things are getting copied to, as long as they're moving out of the queue file. That's not to say it'll just copy stuff to whatever happens to be within range. I'm just saying you can tell it, look, I'm going to copy all of these files over now to this device, or from this device to this place. And so now you're, you know, those tasks have been marked as resolved. You don't have to worry about those. Just keep processing the later files in the spool. So it is a very cool system. Like I say, it's got modern authentication set up with keys, and it's got encryption. I mean, it's encryption enabled, I guess. So yeah, it's a very, very cool little system of asynchronous synchronization. Don't mistake my enthusiasm for experience. I haven't really given, I just found out about this last weekend. So I have not tested this extensively. I've installed it. I've been messing around with it, but most of my enthusiasm is for its potential. I'm not using an NCP in real life or anything, but I have lots of plans on how I'm going to use it. Because, I mean, really, like I said during the UUCP segment, I mean, I really think that there's something to be said for the idea of the asynchronous workflow, which I'll probably talk about at some point after I've actually tried it in earnest. So next package is wget and wget2. They're not substantially different. I don't think enough to like talk about them as different things. So I'll treat them as a single thing to cover. The main difference, as I understand it, is more in the architecture. Wget uses libwget. So it's, you know, yes, there's the front end, but also it has that separate kind of library backend that other things could use. So wget is a non-interactive web browser, a lot like curl, which I've talked about in a previous episode. And it's great. It's one of those must-have Linux commands. I mean, it's just one of those things that is just it's just such a little workhorse. So the basic classic wget command would be, or the entry level command would be wget, I don't know, example.com. Suddenly you see the output, you see index.html, the default file for that web server or the website, example.com, is index.html. You see the output in your terminal. So that's a lot of ugly HTML. Doesn't render it like a web browser does. You're not going to see the same thing. Well, you are seeing the same thing as in your Firefox browser. It's just, it doesn't look like the same thing because you're seeing the source code of that website. And that works for some purposes. More than likely, or possibly, you're going to be downloading a file and then placing it into a file. So rather than just getting the output in your terminal, you might do something like wget example.com /output-document:myindex.html. Now you have the file myindex.html containing all of the HTML for the index page of example.com. That's for a small file. That's simple. One really cool feature of wget is that it can continue a download of a large file that maybe you didn't get the first go around. So maybe you're downloading a really, really big Linux distribution, 4.7 gigabytes in size or whatever they are, and you only get about halfway through and then your laptop battery dies, you have to go home, whatever. So you get back home, you wget --continue, and then the path to that distro on the internet. And once it starts downloading that distro, it detects that the file, you know, the file name of a file in your current directory is the same as what it's downloading. And so it just appends the bits that it's downloading to the end of that partial download that you have. Very, very convenient. You can download a sequence of files. wget example.com/image_curly-brace, 1.10, --, .webp. Now you're getting image 1, image 2, image 3, image 4, and so on, .webp from example.com/file, which, I mean, that's something I made up. I don't know that those files exist, but imagine that they do. That's how you could get a bunch of them all at once, which can be very handy. Like if you're ever on a website and there's a bunch of images that you need, as long as they're in one location and have a consistent naming scheme, then you can automate it with wget. You can, in fact, mirror a whole site. If there isn't a naming scheme that makes sense, you could use wget dash dash recursive dash dash level something. So the level is how deep in that website you're willing to go. And certainly you can set it to inf for infinite, or you might just say, well, you know what, I'm only really interested in the surface level files. So level, what is that, level one or level two? One of those two. It's either level one or level two, and it only sort of drills down a couple of directories. You could do dash dash timestamping, dash dash no dash remove dash listing, and that is, you're now mirroring a site. The simple version of that command is wget dash dash mirror, and then, you know, example.com or whatever. But that's everything that you're running when you do dash dash mirror. That does recursive, level infinite, timestamp, no remove listing. There are some other options that I sometimes use when mirroring a whole site, specifically dash dash no dash cookies, dash dash page dash requisites, and dash dash convert dash links are all handy to ensure that every page is the latest and the most complete, and that it's basically self-sufficient. That can, you know, mirroring a site can be tricky. Like if there's a bunch of sub-sites and subsections and maybe links off site and stuff, it can get a little bit overwhelming. So really, mirroring a site is nice, but it can get out of hand pretty quickly. Wget also gives you full control over the headers that you're sending along with an HTML or an HTTP request, rather. So if you do like wget dash dash debug example.com, then you get a bunch of information about what you have just done, like what kind of call are you making to that website. And that's interesting in itself, but you can use the dash dash header option to define your own, to write your own header information. So for instance, if a site is coded for whatever reason to deliver different content, substantially different content, to a mobile user versus to a desktop user, you can tell it through a user agent string that you just put into your dash dash header equals quote, you know, user agent colon, whatever, then you can tell it that you're something that you're not. Whether or not that'll trigger, you know, it all kind of depends on what sort of weird server magic that web server happens to be performing to determine what is asking for information from it. But that's one thing that you can do. And certainly user agent is just one example. There's other header information you could insert. And one of the cooler things, I think, is that you can actually expand one of those short URLs. I don't see them quite as much as I used to. I mean, they used to be all over the place, and they are handy. But I mean, sometimes you just kind of feel like, I don't know if that's a link I want to click on without knowing what it's going to. You know, you see like a bit.ly slash u5twx. That's the link, you know, and that doesn't tell you anything. It's easier to remember because it's short, but that doesn't tell you where you're actually going. You can use wget to figure that out. You do wget dash dash max dash redirect 0. So you're not going to redirect your traffic to the place that you're going, but you are going to see where you're going. And that is, like, then you could do something like quote https colon slash slash bit.ly slash you know, whatever the little magical string is, close quote. It resolves that to bit.ly. It makes the HTTP request, and then it encounters the trick on the server that redirects it, which is a 301, and it reports on where it would have redirected to had you not said dash dash max dash redirect 0. So it's a really cool trick, really, really useful. I use that one quite a lot. Well, I guess I used to use it more. Like I say, I haven't actually seen those kinds of links all that often recently. Okay, so that's wget, then wget, and then there's the whois, and I kind of want to say that this is largely not useful anymore. I mean, it's a classic network command in a way. It's the enhanced whois RFC 954 client drive from BSD and RIPE whois programs. It selects the appropriate whois server for most queries. So if you do something like whois example.com, then you get a bunch of legal text and Somewhere in there, there's the registrar who is server, there's the registrar URL, there's the registrar abuse contact, which in this case is empty, the abuse contact phone, which is empty, domain status client delete prohibited, domain status client update prohibited. You get a lot of non-information, really. And the same goes for, I don't know, for really most websites, to be honest. I mean, let's do an internet search for what is the best Linux distro. Okay, so here's techradar.com. That's a website that exists. We'll do whoistechradar.com. Should probably just do this for, pipe that to less in the future. But anyway, so we've got our registrar is www.lexsynergy.com. Updated date was 2020. The creation date was 2003. The abuse contact is abuse@lexsynergy.com. This is actually more information than I kind of expect. This is correct. Yeah. Further down, though, the registry database contains only .com, .net, .edu domains and registrars. So domain name is techradar.com. And this is where it'll start to get a little bit silly. Registrant name, redacted for privacy. Registrant street, redacted for privacy. Registrant city, redacted for privacy. And it just goes on like that. I mean, it's a lot of, again, just non-information for privacy purposes. It used to be that you could look up who is, and you would see a person's name and telephone address and email, and that was how you contacted the owner of a server or a website anyway. And that was like, I don't remember, like, I mean, I stopped doing who is at some point because it just wasn't interesting to me anymore. But I mean, within the past probably 10 years that there used to be like really surprisingly useful information, assuming that it was information that was authentic. You didn't have to put real information in there. You're supposed to, but you didn't have to, trust me. So that's who is. It is a query. It is not entirely useful at this point anymore, which I think, you know, I mean, like, I think in one way that's obvious, like in the modern world where there are billions of people on the internet. I don't know how that would work. Just here's my information. Just be nice with it. But on the other hand, there are a lot of websites out there that kind of set up the pretense of like a customer and service relationship. But then when you need customer service, there's nobody. Like, I mean, Google is the really obvious example. Microsoft is another one, although in some cases I think Microsoft does a better job of it. I mean, like, who, you know, people say like, oh, this isn't working for me, or I can't access this thing, and it's like, there's just no, what do you do in those cases on the internet? You just don't do anything. You can't get anybody's information to follow up on a problem. And I think that's a problem. I think that's a very anti-consumer kind of stance for especially the internet to have. I understand that it is kind of, it's still to this day a pretty weird model, the internet. Like, people are still trying to kind of figure out how internet websites can exist and be, I guess, maintainable, sustainable. I hesitate to say profitable, but I mean, for some people that's the goal, right? So, you know, it is a weird business model. We still are, I don't think, you know, 20, 30 years into it being a thing, I don't know that we've, I mean, I know the internet's ancient, but I mean, like, really, you know, a popular thing, I don't know that we have really figured out the correct way to treat people like human beings, just on the internet. Of course, obviously, we figured that out in every other way. Okay, next package, that was sarcasm. Next package is the WireGuard tools, and this is a great one. This is a little bit like the VLAN package in a way, because it isn't what you think it is, or maybe it is, but WireGuard. So WireGuard, you might recall I talked about WireGuard a little bit. I hinted towards it back in the episode that I was talking about OpenVPN. And I said, OpenVPN's too hard to set up. You should just use WireGuard. And no one questioned that. None of my listeners, I got no listener feedback arguing against that. So I feel like maybe that's not the most contentious statement. And WireGuard, I think, widely regarded as kind of like being as easy as SSH is to set up. And I think I can kind of demonstrate that, like, literally right now. And I'm going to do that according to WireGuard.com/quickstart. It's a really, really good document. Documentation here. This is how documentation ought to be done. It's a world of difference between WireGuard and, say UUCP. So this is really nice. It starts a little bit scarily with a video, which can admittedly be difficult to follow along with, because if you're actually literally trying to follow along with it, you're clicking pause and going back to your terminal. And, you know, so yes, having it written out is preferable, but they do write it out after the video. They give you all the different commands that you need to run. They give you a bunch of different options, which, again, admittedly can be confusing. Sometimes all you want out of a document is the way to make it work, like right now. And that's just, I think, the difference, the thing to remember while setting up WireGuard, and a lot of technology really, is that there are two stages. There's the proof of concept stage of where you're just establishing, does this technology work as advertised, and am I capable of implementing it with either my level of understanding of how all the related technology works, or the resources I have, like the physical hardware, software, like network infrastructure that I have available. So that's the step one, is just proof of concept. Can it work? Can I see that it works? You know, and I think in a way the best example of that is the Apache web server. Like, you start the Apache web server, you open a browser, you go to localhost, and you get a message: it works. That's proof of concept embodied. So then the second step is, okay, how do I need to set this up at scale? Like, what do I need to do to make this proof of concept work for my entire organization, or for my entire network, or for the purpose, you know, for the specific use case I have in mind? So what I'm going to demonstrate is more of a proof of concept of how quick it can be to set up WireGuard, because I think in many ways that's the big appeal of WireGuard. Not necessarily, oh, how fast can you set it up, but how many things do you have to keep in your brain while you're trying to figure out how all of these components work together? With WireGuard, it is really, really easy compared to the other options. So the first thing on, let's call it Peer A, because that's what the video calls it. So we'll have Peer A and Peer B, and we're going to kind of configure them simultaneously, or not simultaneously, but sort of in tandem, I guess. Is that simultaneously? We're going to do it a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So first thing, I'm going to just do a sudo -s to drop essentially to a root prompt, which I never do. But in order to get to etc WireGuard, that's kind of what you have to do. So /etc/WireGuard is the configuration directory for WireGuard, which must contain a private and public key for your VPN to operate. You know how SSH has the SSH gen key command, or whatever it is. It is SSH gen key, right? Something like that. Key gen, whatever. Now I have to try it. Gen key. Surely. No, it's not. It's key. Yeah, it's key gen. SSH - key gen. Okay. Well, there's a difference. WG space gen key is what WireGuard uses. And there's about three different commands in the key generation process, but the WireGuard page has a really, really cool sort of combo command, which is just one of the coolest ones I've seen in a while. So it's WG space gen key pipe T, that's T-E-E, so that's going to send the output to two different places. One of those places is going to be private key, and then the other place will be to standard out, which we'll use as the input for another pipe character, and we'll do WG space pub key and redirect that output to public key. So again, that's WG space gen key space pipe space T space private key space pipe WG space pub key redirect public key. You do that, and you just, it's like magic. You get a private key and a public key in your current directory, the private key having been generated by WG, by WireGuard tools, and the public key being derived from that private key. It's very, very cool. I love that command. And I'm going to do the same thing over on peer B, my virtual machine. So I'll do sudo -s first of all. I don't know if that worked. Who am I? Yes, it did work. Okay. That's because I changed my PS1 prompt to be shorter, and now it's showing me the same thing. Okay, so anyway, I'm basically at a root prompt now. So I'm going to go to /etc/wireguard, do an ls just to make sure it is empty. It is. So now I'm going to do wg gen key pipe t private key pipe wg pub key redirect into public key. Do an ls, and sure enough, I have private key and public key. Standard disclaimers apply here. You don't want to ever share your private key with anyone. That stays on the server. That is a sensitive file, so keep that in mind. Okay, so the next thing to do is we're going to do this again, kind of on the same, you know, same set of commands on each, but the first thing that we'll do is ip link add WG0. WG0 is an arbitrary name for our VPN. It's the first WireGuard we've set up, so we may as well label it WG0. And we'll define this as, get this, type WireGuard. Yeah, WireGuard is built into the Linux kernel now. And I say now as if though I was waiting for it for years. I didn't know whether it was included or not. I don't know when it got in, but if you're listening to this and running Slackware, you know, 15 or above, then you certainly have a kernel. Well, unless you've compiled something really old and somehow retrograded back into a different kernel, but you're 15 and above, you're definitely running a kernel with WireGuard built in. So it's just that the type of connection that you're, or the link that you're adding, is of a type WireGuard. So your kernel understands what that means. And now we do another IP command, IP adder add. And this one is going to be, and I say adder, A-D-D-R, where you could type out address or just use the letter A, IP A add. I'm going to do IP A-D-D-R add. And now I need an address to add to my VPN. So I'm going to do 10.10.10.01/24. And I forgot to tell it where to add that. So IP adder add 10.10.10.01/24 and then dev WG0. So I'm adding the address to this imaginary thing, this WireGuard, you know, sort of, if you will, sort of a almost a fake device, WG0. So that's, and I just made that up. Like I've just made up 10.10.10.01. That's not what my network is based around. That's not really an address on my network. It is something that I have invented just literally in the moment. And as I say, the WG0 device, you know, theoretical device, that'll show up. Like if you do IP adder show, you'll see, like if you scroll down far enough here. Yep, there it is. WG0, point to point, no ARP, MTU, 1420, blah, 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 10.10.10.1/24. So that exists, that imaginary device, that software-driven device exists now on my computer, and it has that IP address. Okay, so now I'm going to use the WG command again. That's this WireGuard tool command. WG space set WG0 private. Oh, I did WH0. So WG set WG0. So again, WG0 is my fake little, my theoretical internet device called, you know, my WireGuard device. And then I'm doing private dash key. And then I am going to do a dot slash private key. So that's the private key file that I generated with that big, long, fancy command that I love in my current directory. And now that is set. And then finally, I can do an IP link set WG0 up. So I'm just bringing that network interface up. Okay, so that was on peer A, but I do basically the same thing on peer B. I do IP link add WG0. I can call it the same thing. In fact, it makes sense to call it the same thing on each host being configured. Type WireGuard. Okay, that doesn't work on this computer, on this virtual machine, because my path isn't set correctly. So I'm doing /user/sbin/ip/link/add wg0 type WireGuard. Same idea. So again, user sbin ip add 10.10.10. This time I'll do 0.2/24. In other words, I'm using the same subnet, same network, but instead I'm not giving it the same the same IP address as peer A, obviously, right? You wouldn't do that. So this is, I'm designating this one as 10.10.10.02 instead of 01, and that's okay, that's fine. Dev WG0, and then I'm going to do WG set WG0 private dash key, and once again, I just do a ./private key. To assign the private key in my current directory to this VPN connection. And then I'm going to do IP link set WG0 up. So I've just brought, I have to do the full path to IP. So user sbin IP link set WG0 up. And now I've got a connection on both of these, or a device on both of these designated to my VPN that each one has its own little IP address, and they're both up. They're both active. Now, if you think of this through the lens of your SSH knowledge, then assuming you have SSH knowledge, and if not, just follow along because it does make sense. But in order for both of these peers, both of these hosts, my desktop and my virtual machine, they each have a private and a public key. We just created it, and then we set the private key to the device, to the WG0 device. So that exists. The disconnect here, like the literal disconnect here, is that host A doesn't know what host B's public key is. These are public keys. They are meant to be shared, just like with SSH. In order to make use of your private key, you have to have the public key of your target. So how do those two things come together? How do you connect them? Well, you do that with, again, WG, one of the commands in this WG package. First step is to literally just use the WG command, like with no arguments. Just type in WG, hit return. You get a little report about your WG0 interface, including, most notably, the public key. That's important. So you've now got the public key for each of your two different, your two peers, your two hosts. You just need to copy the one to the other, and then the other to the one. So in other words, we'll do a WG set WG0 peer, and then I'm going to copy on, this is on host A, so I'll go over to my host B terminal, select the public key, just the public key right from the output, and paste that into my command over on host A. I'll follow that up with, or I'll complete the command rather, allowed dash IPs. And that'll be 10.10.10.2, because that's host B in this scenario. So I'm saying allowed dash IPs is host B, 10.10.10.2/32 in this case. Endpoint, space 192.168.122. My virtual machine happens to be .82. So I'll put that there. And then colon, and then the port that host B is listening on, which bizarrely right now for me is 37302. I don't know why. That didn't happen in previous run-throughs, so I'm assuming that the state of my machines have changed after a bunch of doing this several times over or something, because actually the port should be 51820. So I'm not sure why the port has changed. So I think typically, normally, I think you'll see 51820 as the listening port. But for me, that's not what it is. So that's the end of the command, though. WG set WG0 peer, the public key of the place of the other host, allowed dash IPs, the IP of the other host, or rather the WG0 IP of the other host. Endpoint, the IP, the network IP of the other host, colon, listening port. And then I do the same thing with the host, with host B, which, again, WG set WG0 peer, and then go over to host A's terminal and paste in the public key that it's reporting allowed dash IPs. Of course, that's going to be 10.10.10.1/32 with an endpoint of 192.168.1.1:49328. Again, ignore the port numbers in my demo. It's not what you'll typically see, I don't think. You'll usually see 51820 on both sides. That's the standard WireGuard port. So don't pay too much attention to the numbers here. Okay, so now I should be able to do a WG command and confirm that I have a peer and an endpoint and an allowed IPs. Basically just exactly what I typed in, but WG with no arguments, that's an easy way to get a quick little report on your configuration. Okay, so now I should be able to ping a non-existent IP address. So here I am on host A, and I'm gonna do a ping of, a ping of account, maybe two, 10.10.10.2. That doesn't exist on my network. I'm on a network of 10.0.1.x, and my virtual network is 192.168.122.x, and so I've made up 10.10.10.2, or rather 10.10.10, and I've designated host B as the .2 host, and so I'll hit return here from my host A, and two packets transmitted, two received, zero packet loss. Same deal with host B. I can do a ping 10.10.10.1. Actually, I'm going to do count two again, just so it doesn't go up forever. And there we go. Two transmitted, two received, zero packet loss. Simple as that. So I've just literally followed along with the quick start, and it doesn't get quicker than that. Now, to scale that up, obviously, you're gonna probably move a bunch of stuff into configuration files. You're gonna have to think about configuring what kind of traffic actually goes through the VPN and so on. So you're not gonna go into your day job where your boss has told you, hey, we need a VPN like yesterday. You're not gonna go in this morning and run this quick start and be ready to go. However, you can see how quick it can be. And so just taking that knowledge of, okay, we've got a private and a public key, we need to distribute the public, and each host needs to have its own private, and you know, you've got, and a public, you've got the concept down. You can see it working within like 5 to 10 minutes. All you have to do is scale that up with configuration files and then configuring your hosts and you would use whatever kind of configuration manager or automation package that you would normally use, like Ansible or whatever. So there it is. It's super easy. It's I think leaps and bounds in VPN technology in terms of just being something that you can comprehend. I'm not saying OpenVPN is like not useful and just horrible. You know, like it's great. It does really, really well. I use it every single day and I have no complaints about it. But then again, I didn't have to set it up. It's just in practice, when you do set it up, there's a lot of certificates and a lot of pre-shared keys and a lot of passwords and users to think about, and it can get quite complex to configure and to set up. WireGuard can also be complex, but I feel like it starts from a simpler premise. So try it out, is all I'm saying. Just give it a go. Two more packages to go. Wireless-tools, I say two more to go, two more in this episode. The package wireless-tools includes commands that help you interface to some degree with your wireless card, your wireless networking card. So if you have one, and this desktop, I don't use wireless on it, I'm hardwired. So this is of limited use to me on this machine. That said, there are some really good commands on here that I have used in the past. There's iwconfig, which is a lot like ifconfig except for wireless. Iwconfig instead of ifconfig. In fact, even I can do sudo iwconfig on my desktop and see that I actually do have a wireless card installed on this thing. It's just that I just don't use it. But it's WLAN0, IEEE802.11, ESSID off/any, mode managed, and so on. There's more though. There's if IF rename, so that's interface rename. So if you ever wanted to know how to rename a network device, like the output of IP adder show or if config, or I guess even IW config, to where instead of, I don't know, WLAN 0, it says my wireless card or something like that, this is how to do that, if rename. Now, if rename has to happen really, really early in the process, like literally before the device itself is brought up, the earliest thing I could think of to do is /etc/rc.d/rc.S. That's the system initialization script. That's the zeroth thing to run. That happens really, really early in the boot process. So at the end of that file, I stuck a line /sbin/if rename /pipe/true. That's a little safeguard for myself. I mean, this is a virtual machine. I don't care. I can just roll back to a snapshot. But if I was doing this in real life, I would absolutely have that safeguard in there. And basically what that safeguard says is that if /sbin/if rename fails, or fails to run, or can't be found at all, or whatever the scenario might be, that the failure is interpreted as success nevertheless. And that way my system still boots. So that's really important to do. And I don't even know if this is the approved method, but that's just logically, that's what I figured. Okay, I'll put something that I need to run very early before network interfaces even exist in RC.S. Now, in order for if rename to have any effect, by default, what it does is it looks in a file that doesn't exist yet called iftab, iftab, interface tab. So if you go into, if you do sudo emacs /etc/iftab or whatever editor you want, you can list the name that you want to be assigned to an interface. So I'm going to put my wireless card, and that I don't know. I mean, like, now that I have the opportunity to do this, I have no idea what I would actually, my wireless card, what I would rename these things to. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, it actually works as is. So I'm gonna call this my wireless card. What is this? Well, I'm gonna define this by mac mac space, and then I'm gonna drop down to a shell real quick and do a sudo where is this sbin if No, what am I even looking for? S user sbin IP adder show. There we go. So here's the MAC address of this device, 52:54:00AE0C3B. So I'll just select that and paste it right into my iftab file. So I've got my wireless card. That's the name I want to assign a device. And then new column MAC. That's the attribute I'm defining, new space, then the MAC address, 52:54:00AE0C3B. So I will save that now. And so I've got my configuration file in place, /etc/iftab, and I've got the command in rc.s to run. So I'm going to do a sudo /sbin/reboot. And wait for my virtual machine to reboot. And while that is rebooting, I'm going to quickly look in /var/log/packages/wireless-tools and see if I'm forgetting anything. Oh yeah, iwlist is actually a really cool command. And iwspy potentially is really interesting. Both of those give you a lot of information about the stats of your wireless interface, or just a lot more information about that interface. I did used to use those a lot more often than I do now. Like I said, now I don't even have a wireless interface that I use on a regular basis. I mean, I've got one on my laptop, but I don't really use my laptop all that often. IWPriv sets drivers for private IO controls. I've never used that one before. IWGetID, that shows the ESSID or NWID of a device. So yeah, you can probe a lot of information, in other words, about specifically your wireless interfaces. I don't know how if rename got into this package, because it really is broadly useful. You don't have to use that on a wireless interface. It can be any interface, IF, interface, rename. Okay, my virtual machine is back up. So I'm just going to do a sudo user sbin ip adder show. And here, yeah, there's a eth. So my second device on this virtual machine is now called my wireless card. It's not actually a wireless card. It's a virtual Ethernet card. But because it had the MAC address 5254 blah, 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 the if rename command in rc.S detected, it detected that configuration. And then when that device was being brought up, there was a rule in place that if it matches this MAC address, then we're going to call it my wireless card. So I don't know. I mean, it is funny. I feel like for a very long time, it was kind of like, how do I rename my network interfaces? Like they're so cryptic and they're just all over the place and I never know what to expect. And now it never comes up and I don't know why not. It's really strange. Now that I know about if rename, I can't think of when I would use that. Okay, last package for this episode is the WPA_supplicant package. This, I kind of used to use this a lot more than I do now. It is a command to negotiate WPA encryption when you're signing on to a wireless network with WPA or WPA2, more commonly nowadays. And it's really useful, except you're never going to use it if you use something like, you know, like a network manager. That said, it does have a really useful little GUI that it ships with, WPA_GUI, as well as WPA_CLI, command line interface. So you've got a couple of options, and you don't necessarily need to be running a network manager in some cases. WPA supplicant can kind of be that for you. The way that I used WPA supplicant, and I guess the way you would probably use WPA supplicant is just from, well, I don't know how you're going to use it. The way I used it was from the terminal. And the process is that you first need to know what network you're trying to connect to. And in some places that's, without a network manager, for instance, that can be difficult to do. Luckily, we have wireless-tools, which we just talked about, and that has that one command, iwlist. So as long as your wireless interface is up and running and ready to be active, you can do an iwlist to get to essentially scan the radio waves around you for a wireless access point, an ESSID, a network name. So you'll get a list of network names as you normally do when you, I don't know, turn on your cell phone or open up a network manager on your desktop or on your laptop. You see a bunch of other networks like your neighbors and the free city Wi-Fi and all these other, you know, networks that you don't care about. But you filter through it all and eventually you find the network that you want to connect to. Okay, great. Now you have the network name. Now you need to tell WPA supplicant, which is the application you're going to use to connect to that network, you need to tell it what that passphrase is. The easy way to do that is with WPA_passphrase, which is part of this package. So if you do user sbin WPA_passphrase, not supplicant, passphrase, space, quote, my wireless network, whatever, doesn't really matter. This is all imaginary. And then the passphrase. So I'll just do my bad password 123. Okay, I'm going to hit return. And what that gives you is this nice little configuration snippet. Network equals curly brace SSID equals my wireless network, PSK equals, and then the your passphrase encoded correctly for WPA, close curly brace. You can copy and paste that, or you could just pipe this into or double pipe it or whatever you want to do. Get it into a file called /WPA_supplicant.conf. That way it's stored forever. It'll remember that passphrase. You don't have to type it in every time. It's that passphrase is associated with a network by that name. Then you can do sudo WPA_supplicant -i for interface, And then, you know, whatever your wireless card is called, my wireless card, for instance, or maybe it's WLAN 0 or, you know, whatever IP adder show reports as your wireless interface. From that point, WPA supplicant looks for that network. If it finds a network matching that name, then it sends a passphrase, your passphrase to that device and attempts to join the network. Assuming it works, you're online. It's that easy. It's actually quite easy. I didn't use a network manager for the longest time because joining a network was that easy, and it just didn't even seem to make sense to bother with network manager, again, at that time. Since then, I kind of default to network manager because it works really well too. But if there's a reason that you don't want to run Network Manager, it's quite possible that you can configure WPA supplicant and just launch it when you need to join a network, or do the IW list, discover the network, get the passphrase, and use WPA underscore supplicant. It is not difficult. It's surprisingly easy, I think. And the workflow is IW list for the list of networks, which you do tend to want to do. I like to copy and paste the name of the network because mistyping is easy to do. So copy and paste that, create a configuration file, or add to your existing configuration file. If you're creating it, use WPA underscore passphrase. If you're adding to it, then just go to /etc/WPA_supplicant.conf and then join the network with WPA_supplicant-i for interface and then the name of the interface. You're done. And we're done with this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.
Convinced of what he says, it's pathetic.